today. We've heard a lot of news this week about the new Trump administration and the way federal agencies now communicate with the public. How do scientists in Illinois feel about this?
People need to understand that there are no alternative facts. Scientists are aimed at determining how the world around us works. You know, we're there trying to help them.
And what will this new administration mean for the hundreds of millions of dollars in federal funding that come into Illinois for scientific research? Also, Chicago Representative Will Guzzardi is taking his idea of free college tuition to Carbondale and SIU.
I think what we need to do is offer people something new. We need to show people that government can make their lives better.
Plus, the Chicago-based artist and calligrapher behind the Dear Women Project. The idea is for women to send handwritten notes to other women who inspire them. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. All week, we've been talking about how the new Trump administration will affect different aspects of Illinois' economy. We've discussed agriculture, manufacturing, and healthcare. Today, we wanted to focus on science. Illinois is home to the Midwest's largest federally funded research lab and center, that's Argonne National Labs. That alone, 5,000 jobs and $600 million in federal research funding to Illinois. The University of Illinois receives more dollars from the National Science Foundation than any other university in the country. Just two examples of how science affects the economy here in Illinois. What we thought we'd do was reach out to scientists from across the state to join us for a discussion, hear their thought on what they think the future holds under the Trump administration. In a few minutes, we're going to be speaking with physicist turned Washington lawmaker who's going to be joining us to share some concerns he's been hearing from his former colleagues at Fermilab. But first, we're starting with two academic researchers. Peggy Mason is a neurobiology professor at the University of Chicago, and Donald Wibbles is a professor in the Department of Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois. This Friday afternoon, he's actually on a panel that's speaking at an event titled, What Does a Trump Administration Mean for Science? We'll tweet out details for that event if you follow us at 21ST Show. We can also post that to our Facebook page and the web. Peggy, Donald, welcome to the 21st. Thanks so much for being with me.
Thanks, Nyla.
Absolutely. Happy to.
Donald, let's start with you. President Trump has said a number of things that have been perceived in the scientific community as being anti-science. I'm thinking about calling global warming a hoax during the campaign, urging the U.S. to withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement, which is aimed at reducing greenhouse gas emissions. For the position of Energy Secretary, we're looking at former Texas Governor Rick Perry, a climate change skeptic and obviously not a scientist. What are your thoughts on what you're most concerned about with the incoming administration?
Well, it's not only my concern, I think the concern of all the scientists across our community and those who try to study the atmosphere, study the Earth's climate system, is that, you know, we're very concerned about what may happen. We know this to be an extremely important, serious issue. The science is very clear. There aren't any doubts about it. You know, there is no hoax. This is the science is very real that our climate is changing, and it's changing very rapidly. So we're very concerned about that. But at the same time, President Trump really hasn't done anything yet that really impacts upon, you know, what we've done in the climate. He hasn't dropped out of the Paris Agreement. So we'll just have to kind of wait and see what really happens over the coming weeks and months.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that not long after the election, his transition team did ask the Department of Energy to provide the names of employees who've worked on issues related to climate change. Ultimately, that request never went through when the Department of Energy refused. What, Donald, I wonder how that worried researchers in the climate science community, what your thoughts were, what other people were talking about?
Well, it's certainly been the subject of a great deal of conversations amongst all of us. I'm at the annual meeting of the American Meteorological Society in Seattle right now, and at the president of AMS's special breakfast. And so there are 20 some of us in the room, and that was the major topic. You know, what is going to happen? How do we prepare for it? How do we respond to it? And it's certainly in our minds.
Peggy, what about you? You're at the University of Chicago. You're in the neurobiology department. What are your concerns right now?
Well, I'm worried both as a scientist and as a citizen of the world. And I think that on a global level, I'm worried because the very essence of this individual who has become our president is antithetical to the way that scientists work. We work with facts. And those facts are things that we can all look at the evidence, and we all are interested in the evidence, and we're interested in whether the facts are true or not. We're not wedded to the facts, we're wedded to the evidence. And we like to discuss, and personally, I actually like to be wrong. I like to think one thing and then be proven wrong, because it gives me much more growth than being right. And here's an individual who doesn't like facts, doesn't like any pushback, and I think it's an extremely worrisome example. On a more specific level, I'm worried about issues such as vaccination, where there's been an indication that the president may encourage those who have followed a fraudulent scientific piece of work that was retracted in thinking that the vaccinations, for example, might lead to autism. They don't. They do not. And now, if more and more people are allowed to withdraw and not be vaccinated for voluntary, very unsupported reasons, we're going to lose herd immunity. We're going to have more cases of polio, more cases of measles. Measles will lead to deafness in some proportion of the people that contact it. And these are things that are going to impact the ability for citizens to have the lives that they richly deserve and want to have. And I would also say, as we talked about a long time ago, about my work on social neuroscience, one of the things that's been very evident to me is how upset people are and how belittled they feel. And I worry that we're going to have a sort of a national crisis of cortisol, a national crisis of stress that...
Right, and this is actually, I've had previous discussions with you. This is your area of research. You actually study stress and how this impacts our brain and sort of feedbacks that create. That's actually a whole other topic of, but it's an interesting point that you're making there. Do you feel like this administration for... what we would say maybe half the country is creating a situation where people are, you think we're sort of increasing stress for the whole country?
I think we're increasing stress for a lot of people, that the idea that our leader is comfortable making fun of people, I think that's really problematic. So on a personal level, it would appear to me that he can cause stress in a way that President Obama never did. An additional...
Well, it's interesting because I bet some people would say they think President Obama did cause them that stress, right?
There's stress when your party doesn't win, right? And so, yes, there's arguably some stress happened when Obama won and Romney didn't.
But to your mind, this is different, right?
But my perception is that this is a little different. For example, he has a zero net favorable rating right now, which is very unusual for a presidency that's a few days old. So it feels different. In the case of social neuroscience, one of the fundamental things that we know is that isolation, social isolation, is very bad for us. It shortens our lifespan. It decreases our quality of life, and it can lead to mental health issues. And I would argue that the mass incarceration that is our prison system is a place where Obama was just starting to work on this, and now it looks as though whatever progress he had made, and he made some of it through simply using the presidential pardon, quite a bit, but whatever progress he's made is now going to be reversed.
Well, and when we think about, I think certainly to your point about stress, I imagine academic researchers are probably seeing more stress than the average person right now in the U.S. And I wonder, Donald, when we're thinking about scientific research, we're thinking about federal funding for that. I'm thinking in particular of the EPA. President Trump appointed Scott Pruitt, an Oklahoma attorney general who's opposed environmental regulations, to be in charge of the EPA. Earlier this week, the Associated Press has reported that President Trump issued a media blackout for the EPA, barring staff also from awarding any new contracts or grants What does this mean for researchers who rely on EPA funding? Is this something that will affect you personally, Donald?
Well, it also affects existing grants and contracts, and I have one of those, so that's something I'm especially concerned about. It's not clear yet whether it affects all of them or not, but since mine does relate to climate and how particles in the atmosphere affecting both climate and air quality may be changing in their concentration, it could easily be affected by this. So we'll have to see how that goes. What's happening with EPA is of great concern to us in general. We should not be trying to affect science in this way. If the problems are not going to go away just because the U.S. decides it's not going to pay for research for them. These are still going to be very important problems, and they do affect American lives in a large sense because of the impacts on human health and many other aspects of our economic system, our energy systems, and so forth. So we really, as a people, need to be very concerned about any effects on science.
I just want to say that I agree totally with Don that the effects of loosening regulation on air, water, and not reversing or attempting to reverse the problems, it does have a huge impact on health.
And I wonder for both of you, on a practical level, do you think that basic research, and, obviously, Peggy, you're talking about public health implications of climate change, but I'm also thinking just about, on a more simple level, basic research, how much do you think that will be impacted by the new administration in terms of, as you've said, funding? Don?
Well, I don't think we know yet. I think we have some signals that they're likely to be more interested in technology and more interested in research that helps industrial competitiveness. And so that may have an impact on basic research. I'm hoping National Science Foundation kind of basically leads the United States in the real basic research. Most of the other agencies are more applied at specific aspects of the issues, like EPA's work on air quality or climate. We don't have an indication yet that the National Science Foundation research is going to be affected, or that NIH's research is going to be affected, but we just really don't know. And there's some indications through the Heritage Foundation's proposed presidential budget that science may take a large hit in general. And that would, I think that would be really disastrous for the United States.
When we think about administrations coming in, I imagine that there's always administrations that like to fund different aspects of scientific research. President Obama spent a lot of time talking about renewable energy. There was lots of conversation about that and funding that area. Do you have a sense, Donald, I wonder if you have a sense that you feel like this administration, this is something that's different from do you feel like this is a different emphasis? This isn't just a case of presidents being interested in an area. Do you feel like you're under attack?
I think we do to some degree. I don't know if you actually knew this, but I was at the Office of Science Technology Policy for the last year and a half and just left there a few weeks ago. That's part of the executive office of the president. And so I gained a great appreciation for President Obama's interest in science during that time and how much he really appreciated the work that we did as scientists and trying to develop the right policies that dealt with science. But I'm not sensing that right now. I'm kind of standing back and trying to give President Trump a kind of wait and see attitude. So I don't want to be too strong of statements. But certainly I think within the community, the science community, we're very concerned about the direction things may take.
Peggy, what about you? Do you feel like this is different?
I largely agree with Don. I'm a little bit less optimistic, and I think that the general attitude that he has shown throughout his campaign and since the inauguration is one that is very anti-science in spirit, in style and spirit, and so I'm not optimistic. But as Donald said, nothing's happened yet.
One last question for both of you. What do you want people who are not scientists to think about this? Peggy?
I want people who are not scientists to know that we scientists are with them, and we want to work towards a better society with the general public.
Don?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think the people need to understand that there are no alternative facts. That scientists are aimed at determining how the world around us works. We are not. We're there trying to help them in all ways. We're just trying to understand how everything works, how we can help that improve. So I would suggest that as much as possible, they should be contacting their members of Congress, both congressmen and senators, towards making sure science is protected, because it's of such great value to our country.
Donald Wibbles is now in the Department of Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Illinois. He has an event, if you're in the Champaign area, on Friday at 4 o'clock, talking about a panel discussion titled, What Does a Trump Administration Mean for Science? We'll tweet out more details for that. I want to thank also Peggy Mason, who was in the Department of Neurobiology at the University of Chicago. Peggy, Don, thanks for being with me. Thank you.
Thanks, Nahala.
Certainly happy to.
We're going to take a break. Coming up, we'll be speaking with Representative Bill Foster. The former Fermilab physicist district now includes Argonne National Labs in suburban Chicago. Also yesterday, the Associated Press is reporting the Trump administration is scrutinizing data and studies from the EPA. We'll talk with a science journalist in Peoria about what's going on. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Listening to The 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about the impact of the new President Trump administration on different aspects of Illinois' economy all week. Today, we're talking about science. We just finished speaking with two Illinois scientists who've been sharing their concerns about what they perceive to be anti-science statements, actions on behalf of the Trump administration. We're joined now by Congressman Bill Foster. He's a former physicist at Fermi National Lab in Batavia. He's a Democrat, and now his district, the 11th Congressional, is in the southwest suburbs of Chicago and includes parts of Argonne National Laboratory. Representative Foster, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, happy to be here.
Let me start by asking, we reached out to lots of scientists to try to get them involved in our conversation today. And frankly, a lot of them just said they weren't comfortable speaking publicly about this. But I know that lots of people have been in contact with you. What have you been hearing from your former colleagues at Fermilab since President Trump was elected?
Well, since I actually represent 100% of the strategic reserve of physicists in the United States Congress, in fact, I believe I'm the only PhD scientist of any kind. We have maybe a mathematician and some political scientists as well. Then I sort of serve as a lightning rod for this. And there's been a lot of concern and a lot of uncertainty. I think everyone in Washington right now is looking at the mathematically inconsistent promises that have been made by the candidate Trump, the members of the Trump administration, and the long-term policies that Republicans in Congress have been pushing. There are inconsistent promises to increase infrastructure spending or to cut federal spending and balance the budget, to cure cancer or to cut medical funding by various members of the Trump administration. We're waiting at this point and spending a lot of time trying to analyze the positions of the Trump administration's appointees to lead the various federal agencies.
Earlier this week, we saw the Associated Press report that President Trump issued a media blackout for the Environmental Protection Agency, barred the staff from awarding any new grants or contracts, similar news at the USDA, We've also seen lots of statements on Twitter, conversations from the National Park Service account, posted several tweets on Tuesday morning about climate change that were deleted. We've seen the National Park Service said that has told reporters that was from an unauthorized user of the account. But there was a lot. There's been lots of conversation on social media about the fact that people think scientists, people who work on climate change in particular, are being targeted by the Trump administration. Do you think that's an accurate depiction of what's happening?
Well, we have been dealing with this for years on the House Science Committee. Republicans' passion for what are now called alternative facts, particularly on climate change, and some very discouraging efforts on the part of the leadership of the House Science Committee to, frankly, intimidate scientists to go to issue subpoenas demanding their, you know, their work, their emails, things like that. And this is really not the way science should be done. And you also see it in science committee hearings. For example, if you Google my name, Bill Foster and Greenland, together, you're led to an article and a video that shows an interaction I had with a Republican witness who was a lawyer trying to convince us that it was a matter of scientific debate whether or not it was a good thing that the Greenland ice sheet melted. And so, you know, normally I try my best to, you know, stay polite and respectful, but there are times when in committee hearings I am challenged.
Are you worried now that under this Trump administration, what you think you've been dealing with for years on the House Science Committee is now part of a culture that's now in charge in Washington?
Well, I think it will depend a lot on the leadership of the individual agencies. For example, Rick Perry, who's, you know, easy to make light of and who's now the Trump administration's nominee to run the Department of Energy, and is easy to make light of because he actually forgot the name of the Department of Energy on his list of agencies that he wished to abolish and now is being put in charge of it. On the other hand, during his hearing, he acknowledged the reality of climate change, which is very different than the stance he campaigned on. And he acknowledged the necessity for many important aspects of the Department of Energy's mission, and not the least of which is to maintain nuclear weapons for the country.
Congressman, your district includes Argonne National Laboratories. Obviously, you used to work at Fermi. By the way, I should make a note to our audience. We did reach out to both Fermilab and Argonne, the two national laboratories based here in Illinois. Both of them declined our invitation to join the conversation we were having today about science and the Trump administration. But I want to ask you about both of those national labs and their economic impact, because we've been talking about the economy, and I know that when you look at data that's available on their website, on Argonne and Fermi, we talk about the amount of jobs, employers, you know, several thousand. We're thinking in particular, Argonne, I know, in Lamont employs more than 3,000 people. Fermilab in Batavia, almost 2,000. Operating budgets of several hundred million dollars. I know Argonne says $600 million in federal research funding was attracted to Illinois. They estimate their economic impact as $695 million. That's according to figures they provided last year. Are you concerned about any potential loss of federal funding in research, any potential loss of funding to these laboratories, things that could have an economic impact on Illinois?
Yeah, I am very concerned. Particularly concerning is the Trump administration's appointee to run the Office of Management and Budget, Mick Mulvaney. I served with him on the House Financial Services Committee. And he became sort of famous, I think, last September, when he put out a posting questioning the need for any federally funded research at all. And this would obviously be an economic disaster for the area around Argonne and Fermilab. And it's particularly grievous because Illinois itself routinely gets shortchanged in terms of the return of federal tax dollars. Every year, Illinois loses about $40 billion because we pay a lot more in federal taxes than we get back in federal spending. And the national labs are one of the only ways that we have to start to balance a small fraction of that that mismatch. But the real economic damage that would be done by cutting the budgets of the labs doesn't show up in the immediate job numbers or the economic impact of attracting businesses. The real payoff comes over decades, where the scientific advances are responsible for the majority of economic growth in our country since World War II. And so one of the tragedies, I guess, of democracy and science policy is that you can be a hero this year by balancing the budget, by cutting the science budgets, for example, or things like early childhood education, or just education generally, that have payouts on the scale of decades. And so you can be a hero this year by cutting the budget and bragging about it. And then when the economic damage from that happens decades from now, you just blame the other party. And so this is, you know, I think it's a fundamental design problem with democracy that such actions are capable of actually working successfully. I think the only real solution to that is to have the public conscious of the damage that's done by those kind of actions when they take place.
Congressman, now you are in the minority party in the House of Representatives. What's your plan? How do you plan to, as you're saying, this incalculable economic damage you see happening to our country, how do you plan to try to stop that?
Well, I think you have to look at things on an issue-by-issue basis. In some areas, I think it's best if the Trump administration is given the political space to gracefully recede from some of its least rational positions. For example, on the Iran nuclear deal, if the Trump administration fulfills its campaign promise of walking away from the deal, I think it's going to be a disaster. Within a couple of years, we are going to be faced with the choice of either having a nuclear Iran or going to war. And so when this is explained to President Trump, I hope that he has the good sense to back away from those sort of promises. On the other hand, in some areas, I believe, you know, as a Democrat, we will be attempting to make the Republicans pay the full price for their dangerous and irrational and fraudulent promises.
Do you see anything good coming from this administration for science? We've heard a discussion about reviving the nation's infrastructure. Or do you have any positive hopes for all of this?
Well, the statements about infrastructure, to the extent that they include science infrastructure, which were, of course, a very important part of the stimulus spending. When we spent a very large amount of taxpayer money on infrastructure in the stimulus bill several years back, aside from just rescuing the economy, it also made a significant investment in scientific and other infrastructure. If the Trump administration's interpretation of their trillion-plus investment in infrastructure includes science, then good things could happen. But as I say, those promises are pretty much mathematically inconsistent with the stated policies of House Republicans. I think in these today and tomorrow and the day after, there is a three-day retreat by the Republicans in which they will be trying to hash this out and trying to understand how they'll resolve this mathematical inconsistency will be very interesting to the scientific community.
Representative Bill Foster represents a Democrat. He represents Illinois' 11th congressional district. Former physicist, as we've been talking to him about science and the Trump administration. Congressman, thanks for being with us.
Happy to be here.
All week, we've been hearing about the Trump administration taking action to halt communications between federal agencies and the media. The latest news involves the Environmental Protection Agency, whose new work is being put under a temporary hold before it can be released to the public. To help us understand more about what's going on, we're joined now by Tara Haley. She's a freelance science journalist based in Peoria. Hey, Tara, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks very much.
You know, at first we saw some reports that President Trump was mandating all EPA studies and data undergo review by political staff before being released to the public. Later, we heard Trump's communication director clarifying there's no mandate to do so. Press Secretary Sean Spicer said that the clampdown on communications was not directed by the White House. Do we know what's going on right now?
The short answer to your question is no, we don't. And there's a lot of difficulty trying to figure that out. Some of that's normal with a changing in transition. It's hard to tell what might be,
transition, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, how much of the transition is incompetent transition and how much is changes we should worry about? And it's not clear because the transition itself is not going smoothly and is fairly incompetent. You can't really say that nothing is coming from the top because I'm certain that some things are coming from the top. That's how it works. At the same time, there may be some self-censorship going on because people want to keep their jobs and they're worried about what might happen. So there may be officials in different agencies that are preemptively putting a hold on things until they get guidance.
Now, do presidents have the ability to alter data performed by scientists at federal agencies?
That's a complicated question. Obama did release an integrity document saying that it can't be compromised by political or other interference, but that was under Obama. And really anything that Obama has done in the executive branch can be undone by Trump. What they definitely can do is suppress information. They can say this won't get published. Whether they can change it or not, in theory, could they force someone to change it? They could try. Would they succeed? I think we already saw with the National Park Services that some people are not going to have anything of that. So it would be very risky for them to try that in an age where there are so many leaks available and so many places ready to report on that.
Mm-hmm.
They're not legally able to do it, but that doesn't mean they wouldn't try.
Tara, you know, in the conversations we've been having today with scientists, we're hearing a lot of concern about the new administration being anti-science. Do you worry that this might further erode public trust of scientists, or maybe do you think it might have the opposite effect, actually?
I actually think we have a bigger concern, which is neither of those. I worry it will polarize science even further because science gets wielded as a weapon from people who want it to say different things. What it will erode is actual shared knowledge and understanding of what is an actual fact. You will have people who believe in the scientific method and what the consensus of the science shows trying to argue one thing, and then you will have people trying to argue the quote-unquote alternative facts. And I think that is the bigger problem. It gets muddled what the science shows, what the consensus of the science shows. Science itself is a process. It's not knowledge itself. It produces knowledge. But if we can't agree on what those outcomes are, we're in a pretty unstable place.
Would you say right now it's too early to say if that's happening?
Well, it's too early to say how far it's going to go. It has already started happening. I mean, we've been seeing it with climate change for years. We see it a little bit with the vaccine, anti-vaccine thing, where anti-vaccine people try to use science to prove their point, even though the science doesn't show what they say it shows. How much further that will go, if it expands or if we'll lose the ground that we've gained with climate science, it's hard to say right now. It doesn't bode well that the executive branch and the President Trump and his appointees have already spoken in such a way as to suggest that they don't accept what the current consensus is.
Tara Haley is a freelance science journalist, a regular contributor to NPR and Forbes. Tara, thanks for being with us.
No problem. Thank you very much.
Coming up, we're going to be speaking with Illinois Representative Will Guzzardi. He's got a plan for tuition-free Illinois that he's going to be talking to us about. He's doing an event in Carbondale this evening, shifting gears from science to education. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Representative Will Guzzardi represents Illinois' 39th district in Chicago, but tonight he's going to be all the way down in southern Illinois at SIU to meet students and discuss his plan for a tuition-free Illinois. And he's on the line with us now to tell us more about it. Representative, welcome back to The 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, the last time we were on your show, you were just starting to talk about your tuition-free Illinois plan. Can you remind us what you would like to accomplish with this?
Yeah, absolutely. Our long-term goal with this plan is to make the tuition at two-year community colleges and four-year public universities in the state of Illinois free for all in-state students.
And last September, I remember you said it's right around $2 billion that the state brings in every year from in-state students at two-year and four-year public institutions. What's your plan for the state to come up with the money every year to make that free tuition happen?
Well, there are a number of ways that we could go about finding those resources. You know, a couple of years ago in 2014, there was a question on the ballot about raising a surcharge, levying a surcharge on incomes over $1 million, a 3% surcharge that would go toward education. And 65% of voters across the state of Illinois, upstate, downstate, Republicans, Democrats, said that they thought this was a good idea. If we could implement that surcharge, that would cover almost the entire cost of replacing tuition. So there's a number of approaches to raising this revenue, but I think that we need to set a really ambitious and aspirational goal of what we want here.
And I wonder, when you think about that, we're looking at Illinois colleges, we're looking at enrollment numbers and whether that's declining at certain universities across the state. How much do you think that's because of high tuition costs? I wonder how much of it might also just be because of the state budget impasse and worries about higher education
absolutely.
Being funded.
Yeah, no, I think it's a combination of factors. I think certainly the budget impasse is a huge factor on people's mind. You know, they're looking at our many of our public institutions, which may not survive this academic year, let alone, you know, 4 years of college. So I understand why families are having, you know, doubts about the success of these institutions and whether it's somewhere they want their kids to go. So I think in order to restore the public confidence in these institutions, in order to get people excited about them, in order to drive enrollment back up so we can have the rich and diverse programming at these campuses, we need to give people a reason to get excited. And I think the idea of making tuition free at these campuses is going to be something that's going to bring Illinois families back into the fold.
I want to just ask you just for a second just about state funding for higher education. And I'm thinking in particular of Chicago State University's had a very difficult time. I mean, what's your sense of what's going to happen to universities like Chicago State? We've seen layoffs at Eastern Illinois. It certainly seems that this precarious situation higher educational institutions have been in the state for the past couple of years has done some real damage.
Absolutely, it has. I mean, you've seen enrollment drop by double-digit percentages at Chicago State, at Eastern Illinois University, at Western, Northeastern Illinois, which is right near my district on the northwest side of Chicago, has faced some serious financial hardships as well. Yes, this budget crisis has been extremely challenging for all of our public institutions, particularly our public universities and our community colleges. And I think, you know, the urgent question on the minds of families who are thinking about sending their students to college is, what is the state going to do? How is the state going to solve this problem? And I think that we need a comprehensive, long-term, sustainable solution to our state's budget crisis that doesn't involve drastic cuts, and it doesn't involve digging deeper into the pockets of working families. We need to resolve our budget crisis by asking the folks at the very top who are doing better than they've ever done to finally start paying their fair share. And when we do that, we're going to have the resources to invest in public universities, to invest in K-12 education and preschool and childcare and mental health and community services, and all the things that we know we need, all the things that have suffered so much during this budget crisis.
Well, and I wonder, Representative, as we think about that, what kind of support you're getting for this tuition-free plan from your colleagues in the State House when, as you've said, we're having a hard enough time simply funding the operational costs of these institutions?
Yeah. We are in the final process of in the final stages of drafting legislation that we're going to file this year. I think I don't anticipate that we're going to get complete tuition-free legislation passed in this General Assembly. My goal is really this year going to be to to try to advance sort of first step. And I don't know exactly what that's going to look like, but some move toward college affordability here in the state. I'm having preliminary conversations with my colleagues about it now as we're working on language. And there's a lot of enthusiasm for doing something to address the high cost of college. And yes, there is the greater budget crisis that we're all very concerned about. But I think at the end of the day, what families are going to want to see when we solve this budget crisis is not just that we went back to normal, right? I think if the resolution of all this is that taxes go up and costs go up and services go down and it's just like it used to be, I think that's going to be very frustrating for the people of the state. I think what we need to do is offer people something new. We need to show people that government can make their lives better and can make the cost of living more affordable. And I think by making college less expensive, that's going to be a real sign to the people of Illinois that we see the problems they're facing and are taking steps to address them.
Representative, tonight you are headed down to Carbondale to Southern Illinois University. I know there's a pizza in politics. Are you hoping that you're going to maybe mobilize students across the state to rally around this idea?
Yeah, we are, and we have already. It's been really remarkable to see the energy on campus around this issue. And so we're going to continue traveling around the state to community colleges and universities, talking to student groups and to community members as well about the importance of this issue. And we've got an online petition that's got almost 6,000 people signed on to it already. And we are very excited to mobilize people in support of this issue in the General Assembly.
That's Representative Will Guzzardi for Illinois' 39th District. It's in Chicago. He's a Democrat. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
I'm Nyla Boodoo. This is the 21st. After the presidential election, many women were disappointed they wouldn't see their first female president in office, at least not this time. And one of those women, Emily Asher, decided to do something to try to encourage women to encourage other women despite this setback. The Chicago-based artist and calligrapher launched a new project called the Dear Woman Project. She's on the line now from Chicago to tell us more about it. Hi, Emily. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
So the idea about this is getting women to send handwritten notes to other women who inspire them. How did this idea come to you?
Yeah, so I would say it sort of started in those couple days after the election. And it started kind of in two different areas. So the first one was that I am an artist. I own a wedding stationery company in Chicago, and I just felt like I needed to channel my disappointment and energy in some way. So I started doing watercolor calligraphy quotes and portraits, starting with Hillary Clinton, just to kind of like as an artistic outlet. And then I decided, oh, I really want to make this into a project. And I posted on Facebook about it to see if anyone had any suggestions, just on my personal Facebook page. And I got over 200 responses with suggestions. So I was really inspired. And then the other thing was that just kind of going around, there were some people talking about writing thank you notes to Hillary Clinton, kind of just thanking her for what she did in spite of her loss. And so I started thinking about just the power of a handwritten note, and I actually went back through this box of handwritten notes that I have that I save, and there were so many just wonderful notes from people in my life, and most of them were women. So I kind of put those two ideas together, and I launched this project. So every month I'm debuting a new woman on a design for a greeting card, and then the idea is that I hope people will write letters to inspiring women in their life, just to kind of support them, thank them, encourage them.
Yeah, and Emily, when you think about this, I write a lot of notes to people, and I feel like my handwriting is kind of terrible, and I feel bad about that. And for a long time, I think I didn't write as many notes as I wanted to because I felt like my handwriting wasn't beautiful. Like I imagine yours is, at least based on what I've seen on your website. And I did get over it, but I wonder because people seemed really happy to get handwritten notes for me. But I wonder, what do you tell people who worry about having terrible handwriting? Because I sense this is a large part of the reticence for why people don't do this anymore.
Yeah, totally. So, well, first of all, I think there's something about handwriting, no matter how messy it is, that it's just this very distinctive personal touch. And I have certain, you know, my grandma has a very distinctive handwriting. It's almost illegible. Sometimes it's a cursive. And I don't care that it's hard to read, you know, it's just, that's her handwriting. And so I think there's just something really personal about it. It kind of shows that you spent the time to sit down and write it. And, you know, I'm a person with really good handwriting, and I don't care when I receive a note with messy handwriting. I used to be a high school English teacher, so I read through a lot of papers with bad handwriting.
Yeah. And then do you think there's also part of it, what do you think is different about organizing? We were talking about this in the office this morning, actually, all the producers and I, about when you're writing something by hand, we're so used to typing or texting or emailing, you can edit it right away. I wonder, do you think the process of writing something out by hand maybe sometimes can help you put words to feelings you maybe hadn't thought about expressing?
Oh, absolutely. I think there's something about sort of the slower pace of writing something by hand that really kind of forces you to be thoughtful, and to really kind of think about what you're saying. And maybe the fact that you can't edit it really makes it a little bit more spontaneous at the same time. And, you know, you don't feel the need to go back and edit it and re-edit it. It's just, it's there, and it's kind of just from the heart.
So on your website, you have photos of letters you've received for people. You mentioned your grandma. What are some of the letters that have impacted you the most?
Yeah, so that letter from my grandma is one that I definitely cherish. She wrote it to me after my sister's wedding. And there's so many. My dad and my stepmom always write me these really long notes for my birthday, so I have those. I have a note from my mentor just kind of encouraging me in my career. I have a note from a really good friend of mine asking me to be her bridesmaid in her wedding. And so, yeah, that's the banner on the website, is all those notes that I kind of splayed out on the floor and took a picture of, because that's really kind of the heart of the project.
So you're donating 25% of the profits from these designs, from the cards that you are doing every month with these women's designs, to different organizations. For January, can you tell us where you've decided to donate the proceeds to this month?
Yeah, so January's featured woman is Emily Dickinson, and the quote is her kind of famous quote about hope. Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tunes without the words and never stops at all. So because she's a poet, I wanted to find an organization that supported girls and women in writing and reading. So the organization is Girls Write Now, and it helps women in New York City, girls and women, with their reading and writing skills.
Now,
so
I'm,
every month we're going to have
a different
organization that we're supporting.
And I know you created a free downloadable poster to commemorate the Women's March on Washington. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So unfortunately I couldn't go to the march because I had already planned a trip months before. So I was kind of bummed about that, and I wanted to participate in some way. So I put together a design featuring a quote by Coretta Scott King, and I made it available as a download on my website. And actually, now that the march is over, the Women's March, I don't know if you know about this, but they have a new campaign called 10 Actions in 100 Days. And so in the first 100 days of the administration, they're kind of suggesting actions that you can take. And the first one is to write a letter to your representative, kind of telling them about an issue that you're passionate about. So they have some postcards on their website that you can download, but I decided to make that poster design into a postcard as well. So yeah, if you go to the Dear Women website, you can actually download that postcard and print it and send it.
Right, and that quote is, women must be the soul of the nation?
Yeah, women, if the soul of the nation must be saved, you must be its soul.
Okay, that's by Coretta Scott King. Thanks, Emily Asher. We are unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you for joining us. She's the founder of the Dear Women Project. She's based in Chicago. She's an artist and calligrapher there. We'll tweet out all the links, actually, if you follow us on Twitter. We'll have it up on our website as well. Emily, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Speaking of the March on Washington, tomorrow we are going to be talking about the Women's March, the marches that happened here in Illinois, following up with organizers and women who attended to see where they are going from here. Thanks for tuning in for us today. That's all the time we've got for 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. You can always go to our website, 21stshow.org, for information about us. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.